From the pages of the Skeptic magazine, you're listening to the Skeptic Podcast. Since 1987, the Skeptic has been publishing expert skeptical analysis of pseudoscience, conspiracy theory, and claims of the paranormal. Here we bring you selected articles from the Skeptic, since its relaunch as an online news source in September 2020. I'm Michael Marshall, editor of the Skeptic, and first up this week, we have Abby Kennedy's April 2024 article, To Know You More Clearly, What the New Catholic School Syllabus Means 1 Year In. In August last year, the Religious Educational Curriculum Directory announced a release of a new syllabus for Catholic faith schools called To Know You More Clearly, set to be implemented in September 2023. Catholic faith schools represent roughly 10% of state-funded education, and many of them have adopted this syllabus. Currently, students are in their third term of learning under this syllabus. Between the ages of 13 and 14, students enter year 9, a pivotal stage marked by an increased curiosity about the world and increased engagement in social and political affairs. It appears that To Know You More Clearly aims to leverage this developmental phase, intending to foster a deep understanding of Catholic beliefs among students, especially in their outlooks on social and philosophical issues. In secondary schools throughout UK and Wales, including non-faith-based institutions, the introduction of philosophical and ethical debates typically begins in Year 9 with religious education or dedicated social education classes. The objective is to stimulate students' engagement with ideas, broaden their moral comprehension of the self, and enrich their interactions with others and wider society. This approach is echoed in To Know You More Clearly, highlighting the importance of such discussions in shaping students' moral compass and worldview. When students in Year 9 start to examine social issues and philosophical questions, the authors of To Know You More Clearly frequently reiterate that they should do so purely within the framework of the nature of human beings who were made in the image of God. This is the aim of the module, to delve into the mystery imago Dei and how it sheds light on fundamental truths about the human nature. It also aims to examine the moral significance of the beliefs that human life is sacred and that humans are stewards, not owners, of life. These concepts are supported by referencing St. Paul's teaching on the dignity of the human body in Corinthians 6, verses 12 to 20. This passage highlights the importance of using the body in accordance with moral principles and serving the Lord rather than engaging in sexual immorality. It underscores the sacredness of the human body and its connection to Christ. The conclusion to the passage reinforces the idea that human bodies are regarded as temples of the Holy Spirit, emphasizing the importance of respecting and honoring God through one's actions and treatment of the body. In this social issues module for Year 9 students, the syllabus outlines week-by-week debates on different philosophical areas, presenting converging social issues with a unified discussion. One week's topic explores ethical issues related to the sanctity of life, covering such subjects as abortion, euthanasia, IVF, capital punishment, genetic engineering, and eugenics. Examining this within the context of Imago Dei and the connection to St. Paul's teachings on the dignity of the human body, it's difficult not to notice the intentional alignment and implied association between abortion and IVF with eugenics and genetic engineering. Abortion is revisited later in the syllabus with further emphasis on Imago Dei and the sanctity of human life, emphasizing the belief in every individual's right to life and physical integrity from conception to death. In my own Catholic religious education, abortion and IVF were discussed merely to fulfill a requirement, with the teaching centered on their classification as sinful acts against the body as a vessel of God. This framing of the debates surrounding the body appears to be a deliberate attempt to influence undecided young people. In the same module, a parallel comparison of social issues emerges in the section focusing on bodily autonomy. The curriculum delves into ethical issues related to the integrity of the human body, such as torture, kidnapping, domestic violence, and the distinction between gender as a biological versus gender as a social construct. Once again, the syllabus guides students' discussions, more prominently this time, by juxtaposing torture, kidnapping, and domestic violence with the debate on gender, which includes acknowledgement of transgender identities. This implies that transgender identities or experiences of gender diversity are violations of bodily integrity akin to the heinous nature of torture. The language concerning marriage in the curriculum exhibits a similar bias, particularly evident when discussing the difference between civil and sacramental marriage and contrasting civil law with the church's teachings. The syllabus's stance emphasizes that marriage requires a man and a woman for it to be sacramental. This suggests that marriages recognized under civil law, including queer and gender diverse marriages, are deemed invalid according to church teachings. When schools adopt this stance, it implies the invalidity of individuals' identities, potentially impacting their well-being within the institution. The syllabus emphasizes that, by the unit's conclusion, students should grasp the church's teachings on marriage as a lifelong partnership between a man and a woman, freely entered into, which is ordered towards the good of the spouses and the procreation and education of children. This passage employs language laden with significance, notably the term ordered, reinforcing the belief in marriage exclusively between a man and a woman. The use of order implies institutional influence over married individuals, evoking traditional, divinely ordained structures and prescribed lifestyles. It's also essential to note the shortcomings of the syllabus in presenting non-religious perspectives objectively and inclusively. The syllabus postpones introducing an atheist alternative to the Catholic worldview until key stage 3. Additionally, when addressing non-religious perspectives, it claims to be motivated ultimately by love for individuals who do not recognize the universal scope of Christ's salvation. This is emphasis placed on the notion that the syllabus's omission of non-religious perspectives would constitute a missed opportunity. The syllabus teaching atheist perspectives is seen by the authors as an opportunity for those young people in our schools who are culturally and unthinkingly atheist to see the Catholic way of living. There isn't any reference to initiatives aimed at broadening students' perspectives. Atheism is solely mentioned to confront the ubiquitous atheistic worldview which dominates much of our cultural life, and to save and enlighten students who are, to them, atheist by default. In addition to lacking comprehensive teaching on alternative beliefs, this curriculum strongly advocates for the integration of Catholic teachings throughout all subjects. It emphasizes that religious education should influence every aspect of the curriculum, encouraging students to use Catholicism as a foundational framework for understanding all subjects. The debut of this syllabus could significantly impact the cultural and political awareness of its targeted audience, diverting young people from introspection about their identities and decisions. Instead, it encourages adherence to societal conventions and institutions, framing personal identity, relationships, and physical attributes within the context of serving a larger purpose. That was To Know You More Clearly, What the New Catholic School Syllabus Means 1 Year In, first published in April 2024 and written by Abby Kennedy. And next up this week, we have Mike Hall reading Tiago Vallia's May 2021 article, The Great Reset, Political Pipe Dream or Sinister New World Order Plot.
Avid followers of the World Economic Forum will be familiar with the term The Great Reset, the idea that it is time to convince governments and private companies to make a radical change to how they behave. Since COVID-19 began to ravage the planet, causing entire economies to falter and fail, billionaires have accumulated more and more wealth. It's easy to see why there are such strong beliefs that the current system just isn't working. According to the World Economic Forum, this accelerating inequality has created a more unstable and violent world. Arguably, those at the top have recognized that this system is becoming more and more unsustainable and that they will soon start losing money and power if this instability continues. The stated aim of the Great Reset is to implement stakeholder capitalism. Unlike normal capitalism, which could be said to value the maximization of profit at all costs, stakeholder capitalism claims to seek long-term solutions which benefit companies in the long term, but also benefit society, not just the shareholders. Such a global change of direction would have been unimaginably unrealistic a few years ago, But as the authors of The Great Reset point out, the world has rapidly changed to fight against COVID-19, so changing society to institute a better and more sustainable system shouldn't be so hard. That's the official version of The Great Reset, but it's not the only definition that can be found online. When a powerful group suggests such radical change, and with so dramatic a name, it is perhaps inevitable that alarm bells ring for conspiracy theorists. Those alarm bells first began to ring in American conspiracist communities who saw the Great Reset as something much more sinister than the official narrative suggested. For those communities and the conspiracists they went on to influence, the Great Reset is actually a malevolent plan to institute a new world order or global technocracy with the goal of suppressing all freedom and controlling the world. According to believers, the pandemic was deliberately engineered to make the population afraid, so that state control could be expanded as the first step toward this new reality. So their theory goes, if people obey when told to wear a mask, they will also obey orders to have their hands microchipped in order to control where they go, and they will submit to social scores which determine who is good and who is not. The fear of the Great Reset seems completely at odds with what it involves in reality. When you read the details of the plan, it is ostensibly an attempt by Davos and the World Economic Forums to create a more stable world for people, and by extension, for businesses, one that won't be destroyed by climate change. It's a pretty open document to read and is accompanied by podcasts and interviews showing exactly what they want. And the word want is key here. None of this is state policy, it is just a suggestion for the world. There is a tradition of conspiracist reaction to any proposed project of this scale. Alex Jones spent almost 30 years scaremongering about Agenda 21, the set of suggestions and decisions for how to help the environment, which was laid out at Eco 92. Any type of large-scale international collaboration of this nature inevitably becomes the subject of conspiracy theories, and they always posit that these global coordinations plan to imminently remove all liberty and bring about a dystopian future. So, how can we explain this constant fear? In her book, Real Enemies, Conspiracy Theories and American Democracy, World War I to 9/11, historian Catherick Olmsted argues that since the First World War, the constant growth of the state and its increasing intervention in Americans' lives has made the population more and more scared of the government, in particular of its secrecy and its reach. This was further exacerbated by lies around the Gulf of Tonkin incident, which was one of the causes of the Vietnam War, Watergate, and the Iran-Contra scandal, all of which were real conspiracies by the US government that had a vast impact on the life of its citizens. Given this fear and suspicion, it's easy to see why a plan that argues for change to the entire country, or indeed the world, by a government, which some would consider to be hostile and secret about its intentions, would not sit well for some people. Even if the Great Reset really is just a suggestion, the sheer thought of state intervention by the US government is an instinctively bad thing for many people because, as they might ask, who knows their true intentions? In this way, conspiracists capitalize on that fear by alleging that the positive view of the future proposed by projects like the Great Reset is just a Trojan horse. While fighting climate change may be the stated aim, the real goal, believers argue, is that you have to surrender your liberties, and so on. The suspicion conspiracy theorists have toward the Great Reset could also be rooted in the historical discrediting of government and politics as a force for meaningful social change. Throughout the 1980s, political speeches from Ronald Reagan and his UK counterpart Margaret Thatcher laid out a philosophy in which the government is definitionally inefficient, wasteful, and against the interests of its people, and that only private business can truly accomplish anything meaningful. As the decades advanced and governments focused more and more on privatization, those beliefs persisted. In the minds of believers, power may change hands between the parties, but the objectives remain the same. So why believe that governments can achieve anything positive? Anything they seek to achieve must therefore be, at best, bad. for those people, a plan that combines the power of the state with the goals of big business in order to change the way you live in the future is perceived as nothing more than an outright attack. Any criticism could be simply deflected by alluding to the long history of government secrecy, both with real examples and the countless conspiracy theories that supplement them. From the outside, it's tempting to think that the fact that the Great Reset plans rely on an alliance between private business and government should, in theory, allay any fears of totalitarian government intervention. However, with globalist conspiracy theories, the fear of the government is elevated to a fear of a global shadow state, the organization behind all of the individual governments and behind the biggest corporations too. Thus, believers come to see the Great Reset as the creation of a technocracy, where global society will be ruled by big business, helped by companies already understanding the weakness of governments and the ascendancy of mega companies. There are doubtlessly other factors that play into the growth of the Great Reset conspiracy theory, but it is important to understand that conspiracy theories often exist for a reason, and sometimes that reason is fear. The conspiracy theorists offer many different solutions to stopping the Great Reset, including returning to a white Christian society, ending the state completely, and going back to the supposed good old times. For believers, they recognize that something is wrong with the way the world is structured, but any response to these problems that doesn't align with their specific solution is perceived as an attack on all of humanity. The world can only change in the way they want it to.
That was The Great Reset, Political Pipe Dream or Sinister New World Order Plot, written by Tiago Vaia, published in May 2021, and read here by Mike Hall. Next up this week, from the archives, we have Heaven and Earth, Is the Curse of Tutankhamun a Curse at All?, written by Michael Hutchinson and first published in November 1988. Some claims the paranormal have been shown to be completely wrong. Others, although unlikely and as yet unproven, may still have a small chance of being right. In the latter, I include ESP, ghosts, life after death, UFOs, and even dowsing. These phenomena are so ethereal that even if any of them exist, they'd be difficult to prove. That's surely the whole basis of our interest and skepticism. We believe that these things have not been proven in spite of the enormous amount of publicity and support given to them. The former category includes astrology, iridology, palmistry, the Bermuda Triangle, and any phenomenon which has rules or which has a base of checkable facts. These claims are easily looked into and have been many times. They consistently fail to support the claims made for them. Among these phenomena is one which is regularly mentioned by the media but has received comparatively little skeptical comment: the Curse of Tutankhamun. I cover this briefly in my review of Time Life's awful series, Mysteries of the Unknown, and I thought I'd enlarge on it in this issue. The earliest and best skeptical article on the curse that I can find was, not surprisingly enough, written by James Randi and appeared in The Humanist in March-April 1978. The article is motivated by a television special on the curse and a popular book, The Curse of the Pharaohs, by Philip Vandenberg. The first claim made by supporters of this myth is that a tablet with a curse inscribed on it was found in Tutankhamun's tomb. It's supposed to have said, "Death will slay with his wings whoever disturbs the rest of the pharaoh," or similar, depending upon the source. The tablet has since vanished, they tell us. But in reality, there's no evidence that such a tablet ever existed. As in any archaeological dig, all items found in the tomb were carefully noted and documented. No mention of such a tablet is made. Or are the archaeologists guilty of a cover-up? We're asked to believe that the earliest victim of the curse was Lord Carnarvon, the patron of the expedition to find the tomb. When he died in Cairo, the lights of the city were reported to have gone out, and back in England, at that very moment, his favourite fox terrier howled, sat up on her hind legs and fell over dead, as if in sympathy or sorrow. As I mentioned in my previous review, Carnarvon was a sick man when he went to Egypt on his doctor's advice. After recovering from a mosquito bite, he contracted pneumonia and died one April morning at 1:55 a.m. at the age of 57. The lights often went out in Cairo, so it's no surprise that they did so, or at least around the time that Carnarvon died. As for the dog, at least one believer has reported Carnarvon's son saying that it died at 4 a.m., which, taking the 2-hour time difference between England and Egypt, meant that the dog died within 5 minutes of Carnarvon. Wrong, even if the event had occurred as stated. And why was there a witness with the healthy fox terrier at 4 o'clock in the morning? England was behind, not ahead of Egyptian time. As the ultimate penalty of a curse of death, it's therefore not surprising that most of the tales in support of Tut's curse involve the deaths of those who defiled the tomb. The odd thing, though, is how selective the curse is. It doesn't seem to affect those closely involved in the opening of the tomb, as we'll see, so much as those who were on the sidelines. George J. Gould, son of financier Jay Gould, is reported to have died within days of visiting the tomb. But he was just one of many thousands of tourists who'd visited the tomb. Perhaps the curse thought he'd lived long enough, for he died at the age of 59, which wasn't too bad for the early 20th century. Another sideliner we're asked to believe is the victim of the curse is Lord Westbury, the father of Howard Carter's assistant, Richard Bethell, who died suddenly of circulatory collapse some 6 years after the tomb opening. Grief-stricken by his son's death, Westbury committed suicide. Do curses have no compassion? Randy checked Howard Carter's writings and determined who'd been most directly involved in the tomb discovery and exploration. Included in his humanist article was a table listing the names of these people, the years of their deaths, their ages, and the number of years they survived the opening of the tomb in 1922. Some of Randy's data was incomplete as he couldn't trace details of all the people in American libraries. I've therefore updated his list and have calculated the average lifespan and curse survival rates of those ages we've been able to find. Of the 22 people on the list, we know the ages at death of 11, and the years in which another 3 were known to be alive. On average, the 11 lived to at least 72, and all 14 survived with a curse over their heads for almost 25 years each. The shortest and longest survival rates were, ironically, for two of the people present at the initial break-in of the tomb. Lord Carnarvon survived only 4 months. His daughter, Lady Evelyn Herbert, for 58 years. She died in 1980 at the age of 79. The average survival rate of the 22 main participants was 20.9 years. As Randy wrote, perhaps we have here a beneficent curse that inhibits the Grim Reaper. But was there a curse in the first place? Well, not according to Carol Andrews, an Egyptologist in the British Museum, who said on LBC Radio in July 1988 that the idea of a curse probably dates from a Victorian novelist, Marie Corelli, who wrote, "No good will come of disturbing Pharaoh's bones." But more directly, Andrews said that the Egyptians didn't write curses in their tombs. She confirmed that no such curse was found in Tutankhamun's tomb and that Egyptologists wouldn't have expected to find one. She explained that the only curses made by the Egyptians weren't against grave robbers, but against anyone disturbing their funerary offerings of food and drink, which were placed daily in chapels for the spirits to consume. Although the general idea of a curse may have originated with a Victorian novelist, the Tutankhamun one certainly couldn't, except by precognition, which we won't address here. Nearer the truth is the suggestion that it was a story made up by newsmen. On 29th of August 1980, the Daily Mail published an interview with an old soldier, Richard Adamson, then 81 years old. As a military policeman in Egypt in 1922, Adamson was ordered to assist Carnarvon's archaeological expedition to leave the Valley of the Kings. Before they could do so, the tomb was discovered, and Adamson was to spend the next 7 years actually sleeping in the tomb as a guard. Adams told the Daily Mail that as crowds were hampering the digging work and as they were also worried about the possibility of thieves coming in the night, quite suddenly we thought about a curse. Inscription laying curses on intruders had been found in the walls of tombs nearer Cairo, and so it happened that a reporter had been hanging around asking about curses. We saw no such inscriptions laying curses in Tut's tomb, but let's say we didn't discourage him from thinking there was. Adamson's story is possibly true, although his claim about curses on the walls of other tombs seems to contradict Carol Andrews. Perhaps these were curses against anyone disturbing the funerary offerings. Nevertheless, if there really is a curse, having lived to be at least 81 and surviving the curse by at least 58 years, Adamson only supports Randy's suggestion that the curse is beneficent. From the archives from November 1988, we had Mike Hutchinson's article, Heaven and Earth, Is the Curse of Tutankhamun a Curse at All? And finally this week, we have Brian Eggles' October 2023 article, "The Recent Glasgow Low Emission Zone Protest Turned Out to Be More of a Low Information Zone," read by Paul Jenkins.
The white race is being replaced. We are being replaced. These were the first words I heard on Saturday, 30th September 2023, as I wandered into Glasgow's George Square. They were being launched into a loud hailer, or loud hyler, by a member of the afore-shouted race. It's not quite what I expected from a protest about traffic restrictions, but it turns out that there were to be plenty of other noxious emissions unrelated to the topic du jour in the city centre that day. The great replacement scaremongerer wasn't one of the official speakers, but he claims to have been given permission to speak, well, shout, and had procured his makeshift amplification from one of the organisers. Some of the gathering crowd didn't seem happy with the outburst, but others nodded along. As I waited for things to kick off, I scanned the crowd. Middle-aged white men seemed to be in the majority, so I fitted right in without any requirement for disguise. I spotted a "God's Children Are Not For Sale" t-shirt as well, a tip of the hat to QAnon-adjacent child-trafficking fantasy fiction movie The Sound of Freedom, which has been widely criticised for inaccuracies and fabrications. Not a great start to proceedings. The purported reason for the day's protest was Glasgow City Council's implementation of a low-emission zone in the city centre. The legislation aims to prevent the most polluting vehicles from entering the most congested areas of the city and imposes a fine for doing so. At the surface level, it's a common-sense measure to try to prevent the obvious health implications caused by busy traffic in a highly populated area. It's not a perfect plan, of course. The noble intentions come with legitimate concerns that small businesses and people of lower socio-economic status are likely to own the older vehicles which fall foul of such regulations. As with many things, the risk/benefit analysis is crucial. There seems to be reasonable evidence of the health benefits, which should be enough to negate the downsides. But it doesn't take long for the mask to slip and show that the majority of speakers and protesters are only using those legitimate concerns as a springboard into much murkier conspiratorial territory. Talking of masks, the theme of highway robbery is prematurely flogged to death by a lady who has beaten the Halloween rush to an outlaw costume. She dances somewhat unconvincingly to "Stand and Deliver," while theatrically waving her anti-LEZ placard. It is, however, good enough to draw the attention of the somewhat meagre crowd before the speakers commence. Or at least, it would have been if the speakers had started immediately after. It turns out we still had another 15 minutes to wait. The DJ expertly fills the void by playing Madness classic "Driving in My Car." He is later heard asking bystanders for other songs about cars that he could play. Slick. The speaking area consists of what appears to be a gazebo from Argos, with a low-budget PA setup, feedback echoing and complete audio drops aplenty. A poster about 15-minute cities at the back of the gazebo is a further sign that this isn't really going to be just a protest about emission control. Finally, with minimal fanfare, our first speaker finally takes centre stage, well, gazebo, David Icke-like Paddy Hogg. His face looks familiar to me, but I can't quite place it. So I send a picture to my editor, Michael Marshall, who confirms that Hogg was one of the loudest voices amongst the cacophony of hecklers at Marsh's talk for Glasgow Skeptics about the White Rose anti-vax conspiracy theory ecosystem. Hogg gained notoriety with his organisation of anti-lockdown protests in 2020 and further courted controversy with somewhat predictable comments about the Gender Recognition Reform Bill. Since then, he's clearly gone fully down the rabbit hole as he works his way through a veritable greatest hits of conspiracy theories. The Scottish Government is implementing what they're told to do by globalist dictators. Social and economic engineering. 15-minute city oppression. We weren't allowed to question COVID or lockdowns. Climate change denial. The science is not settled. The mainstream media. George Soros is funding Extinction Rebellion. Excess deaths caused by the COVID jab. The PCR test is not reliable. And closing out with a final ramble towards about whether viruses even exist, he advises the crowd to look up terrain theory, a discredited fringe belief from over a century ago. Exhausting stuff. Unexpectedly, the next speaker is the most disappointing. There's the makings of a genuine story here. Colin McInnes is an award-winning founder member of Homeless Project Scotland. They do amazing work. I've seen their van in the city centre myself, helping the most vulnerable throughout the year. That refrigerated van is, however, the root of their problem, as it falls foul of the new guidelines. An appeal to Glasgow City Council for an exemption failed, which presumably fuelled the ire of McInnes. As a result, he seems apparently willing to be the vaguely rational meat in an otherwise conspiratorial sandwich. He says he's less sceptical than the previous speaker about global warming, but that's fine. It's not, by the way. He also says he's a scientist, although I could find nothing to corroborate that. More strangely, though, he says little or nothing about the plight of his charity, but spends more time talking about MOTs and vehicle emission standards. McInnes's speech ends with more sinister tones, though. Quote, they just want to install systems of control. They want to spy on you and your children, close quote. It seems as though he may possibly be in the process of being radicalised by the somewhat questionable company he's keeping, perhaps notable given the fundraiser they kicked off for a new van reached and exceeded its target 3 months ago. The headline act of the day is the Daniel Baldwin of political discourse, Piers Corbyn. He rumbles into George Square in a theatrically battered old car, festooned with anti-LEZ posters, then shuffles over to the gazebo, sporting his trademark dishevelled look. His speech is pretty much the same as many of his speeches from the last few years, and he compliments the first speaker's assortment of tirades to tick off pretty much everything on the conspiracy theory bingo card. The World Economic Forum are trying to bring in a new generation of compliant people, and Keir Starmer will be their puppet. Low emission zones are here to control you. Directed energy weapons. They want to charge you up to £1,500 if you don't install double glazing. Man-made climate change does not exist. Carbon dioxide is the gas of life, and we want more of it. They want to get rid of all cars and planes. Eventually they want us all stuck in the one place. It's part of the 15-minute city agenda. And so on. Corbyn also claimed that the Clean Air Zone scheme in Birmingham had been scrapped. It has not, although there are, of course, many cases of people failing to pay the fine. His own story of non-payment is met with glee by the crowd. In an attempt to customise his speech for the Scottish audience, he refers to Nicola Sturgeon, presumably not being aware she is no longer in power. There's a side note of transphobia as we get near the end of the road. Quote, men are men and women are women. We're against the sexualisation of children, close quote. And then it's all over. All that's left is for a request for donations, after which Piers and his sidekick work their way through the crowd, with Piers himself using what appears to be a takeaway container wrapped in tin foil with Stop the Great Reset sellotape to it, while standing next to a fully grown adult inexplicably holding a child's toy sword. Equally inexplicably, someone else attempts to speak after the Corbyn show. He's wearing a T-shirt with various quotes on it, including George Orwell, predictably, and such luminaries as Jordan Peterson and Julian Assange. He's strawmanning electric car technology, complaining about cycle lanes, and asking people to upload any videos they've taken to rumble.com because they, quote, believe in free speech, close quote. Nobody's really listening much at this point, though, including me, as I'm busy trying to dodge the Corbyn and henchman donation drive that's making its way through the crowd. To avoid the shaking takeaway container, I decide to start a conversation with one of the most interesting-looking crowd members. She's got a lot of large placards, all laminated, all crammed with the worst of conspiracy theories and pseudoscience. She kindly lays them all out for me so that I can get pictures of them. Our conversation heads in the direction of old favourite glyphosate. She says it is very harmful and has been used on crops in Scotland for over 4 decades now. I ask her if it's so dangerous, then why has life expectancy been increasing all of that time? A long, awkward silence ensues, after which she tells me a website to check out. I make my excuses and head off home to gather my thoughts. There was certainly something harmful in the air that day in Glasgow, but it wasn't coming from the vehicles. My only consolation is that not too many people were there to ingest it, and of those who were, most had apparently already overdosed on it.
That was Paul Jenkins reading Brian Eggles' October 2023 article, "The Recent Glasgow Low Emission Zone Protest Turned Out to Be More of a Low Information Zone." And that's all for this episode of the Skeptic Podcast. If you've enjoyed what you've heard, be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and visit skeptic.org.uk for more expert skeptical analysis of pseudoscience, conspiracy theory, and claims of the paranormal. You can support The Skeptic on Patreon by visiting patreon.com/theskeptic, and you can follow us on Blue Sky at skeptic.org.uk. The Skeptic is produced by the Merseyside Skeptic Society in association with the Good Thinking Society and is edited by me, Michael Marshall. Today, you've heard articles from Abby Kennedy, Tiago Vahia, Michael Hutchinson, and Brian Eggle.